Like, how do you come back from torturing 10 men where they were praying for their lives and your response to that was to slit their throats?
When my father was shot 52 times with that AK-47, he was only 38 years old.
You should never bury your children.
It's hard enough to lose a loved one. It's harder still when your loved one is brutally murdered and they're essentially stolen from you. All of the memories you could have made with that person are now never to be. But you feel a sense of justice, maybe even relief, if those perpetrators are caught and given life sentences. But what if life doesn't actually mean life? What are you supposed to do when the murderer who stole your loved ones comes up for early parole simply because they murdered your loved ones before 2004? The scars that had slowly begun to heal are suddenly reopened, and you're expected to face the unfeeling eyes of a murderer and plead yet again for justice to be served, or give up on the memory of your loved one and let the murderer roam free. For Lee Fisser, Roxanne Fanek, and Rob Matthews, this is the injustice they are currently battling with as a result of two court judgments related only to inmates serving so-called life sentences. Our journalist Gillian Gifford, who's been tracking the story for some time, explains the judgments and the ramifications they have.
The Fanek judgment was finalized only in 2017, but it was a case brought by a group of prisoners who are all serving life sentences. They argued that other prisoners qualified for credits and time off for good behavior, and they felt that they should as well. So they approached the Constitutional Court, which agreed with them and ruled that prisoners serving life terms should qualify for credits. So all of them were granted an across-the-board credit of 6 years and 8 months, regardless of their behavior, their history, whether they'd attempted to escape, anything like that. All of them, each life-sentenced prisoner, was granted 6 years and 8 months credit of their life terms.
After leaving the country and maintaining years of silence over her brother's horrific murder, Lee Fisser is now speaking out, and speaking out loudly. Warren Robert Fisser, who was 23, was one of 9 young men murdered in a massage parlor attack in Cape Town's Sea Point in January of 2003, in a hate crime against the queer community. The atrocious killing spree came to be known as the Sizzlers Massacre. Lee was just 14 when it happened.
It was Monday morning and I woke up to my mom screeching. She was just screaming, "Warren's dead, Warren's dead, Warren's dead." And I remember as a little girl, I was like, no, mom's overreacting, something, no, it's impossible. And I guess she learned from the news that Warren was dead. I don't know all the specifics, but I know that's how she found out, and how I found out was me waking up and to her screeches and screams. It was really hard because it was hard to console her. I mean, especially as a 14-year-old girl. And I have another brother, he was 15 at the time. We just didn't know what was going on. We had no idea. And my mom called my stepfather, who was working, and told him what had happened. And he came home immediately, obviously. And they kind of started looking into it together. And eventually, somehow, they kind of realized, or not realized, but they kind of got assurance from the police and the hospital that my brother wasn't in it. And then I guess everything was fine. He went back to work. My mom kind of went about a couple of hours within her day, but she was just so disturbed and unsettled. And she was like, no, he's dead. Like, something happened to him. I can feel it. And she called my stepfather again, and he came home. Eventually, this time, he decided to go around to the hospitals and to see the victims of the Sizzlers. And unfortunately, that's when he found my brother in one of the wardrooms. There were three remaining victims that were rushed over to Groote-Schuur, him being one of them. He ended up passing away of his wounds, and I'll never forget. I remember me as a 14-year-old little girl, I was sitting in my room with the radio on and listening to the reportings. There was constant reportings on the radio, just speaking about this. And I remember at 1 o'clock when they reported that the one of the victims had died, I knew that was my brother, and it ended up being my brother. I remember things like our house looking like a forest or a valley of flowers. We got so many flowers from people we didn't know. Our entire home was filled with flowers. And although it was a sweet gesture, it was just a constant reminder of the brutality and the disgusting violence that was pretty evident in South Africa. And to this day, when a family member passes, or a loved one, or a friend's loved one passes, I never give flowers because I think it's the most cruel thing you can do. Those are some of the things I remember. I remember it being splashed all over the news for weeks, every single week, and there were so many theories in the newspaper, and a lot of them reported really badly and really cruel. Like, I feel like a lot of people were chasing the most gruesome of headlines, and we had to live with that. I remember in South Africa, headlines would be posted to the poles, the lampposts on the side of roads, and it was just impossible to escape. Which is why for many years, I never spoke of this. I never, ever spoke a word of the Sizzlers massacre until this year. My poor husband, I didn't even tell him. He found out online. He knew something happened to my brother. He knew it was big, so he went searching online. And that's how most of the people who know or knew about what had happened to my brother before this year found out through the internet.
She was prompted into speaking out when the Department of Correctional Services informed her that Adam Wust, the man who had murdered her brother, Warren Visser, in the infamous Sizzlers massacre, now qualified for parole, after having not even served one of his 9 life sentences. Lee and her mother met with Wust after he was convicted.
Another question that I get asked is, do I think Adam Wust is rehabilitatable? A very quick answer is no. My mother and myself met with Adam, and he was completely cold. He was like a shadow. He had no emotion. He had no expression. Even when my mom sat there pleading and crying for answers, he didn't once look up. He just had this blank stare, really, really scary and enraging eyes. Everybody that met him and then spoke to the media in an attempt to explain Adam Wust, everybody commented on his eyes and just how emotionless they were, how dead they were. And that is something that my mom found too, is that, and the one thing she describes is that they were just bottomless pits, you know, void of any kind of emotion. And it's scary to think that a man like that was the last person with my brother. I will also probably say that, you know, Adam Wust lacks any kind of empathy. I'm sorry, I do not feel like he is rehabilitatable at all. You know, some offenders are, but a person who committed that level of horrendous and gruesome crime, like I just don't see any way back from them. How do you come back from a crime like that? Like, how do you come back from torturing 10 men where they were praying for their lives and your response to that was to slit their throats, you know, make them scream and pray just for, you know, to save them? How do you then turn a gun at them and shoot them? I don't know. And then, you know, to finish it off with dousing them in gasoline, like, that's a tortured and tormented soul that committed that crime.
Lee, who now lives in Canada, has written to the president and set up a petition to oppose Vust's early release. But her family is not the only one fighting this battle. Lee has also teamed up with Roxanne Van Eck, whose policeman father was shot 52 times with an AK-47 by armed robbers, and Rob Matthews, whose daughter Lee Matthews was kidnapped and murdered a day after she turned 21. The convicted murderers in all three of these terrible cases are now up for early parole, forcing the families to relive the worst days of their lives. Roxanne has no desire to face the men who shot her father 52 times in the head and body, but she hopes that agreeing to meet up with them will allow her to delay their release from prison, and in doing so, fighting for justice, the same justice that her father always fought for others.
My family and I will never forget the day that we received the news of my father's murder. It was a winter's Wednesday morning, broad daylight. You know, my father had worked in the police for almost 21 years, his whole adult life. And of course, we had been scared that, you know, anything could happen on any given day. He did dangerous work serving and protecting our community. But we were scared of the night shifts. We never thought that this would happen in the middle of the day. I remember being in grade 11, sitting in a class and being called out from my class, being collected by two of my father's colleagues, and sitting in the back of a police car, guessing what had gone wrong, why are they fetching me? And I eventually blurted out, "Did someone die?" And that's when they both looked at me, and I knew instantly it was my father. When my father was shot 52 times with that AK-47, he was only 38 years old. These men, if they are released now, they will only be in their 40s. My father didn't get to see his 40s. They will still be able to make a full life for themselves. He never got life. He got a death sentence. We got a life sentence without him. These men do not deserve to come out early.
Roxanne is adamant that despite the pain of having to confront her father's murderers again, she will be at every parole hearing opposing their release. The pain of losing a daughter never goes away. Rob Matthews has first-hand knowledge of this. He often wonders whether his daughter Lee would have been married by now, or perhaps have had children of her own, had she not been murdered.
The hardest parts are the what could have been. Could Lee have been happily married? Could we have had grandchildren? Could we have shared more memories, made new memories, had laughter? We didn't have a wedding. You know, those are the big milestones that parents dream about with the little girls as they grow up, and they dream with their parents, and they talk about what their wedding would look like. Those are things that don't happen to people like us when their kids are taken before time. You should never bury your children.
The story of the Bond University student's kidnapping and murder gripped the nation when she went missing from the Sandton campus in 2004, just a day after she turned 21. Her body was found with gunshot wounds. She was also kept in a freezer before being dumped, according to the court case's findings. Lee's killer was sentenced to life in prison in 2005, yet he too is up for parole. Lee Visser, Roxanne van Eck, Rob Matthews and their families hold a common fear. The fear that the murderers that stole their loved ones are set free without rehabilitation or remorse and are allowed to roam the streets of South Africa and potentially devastate another family.
It is absolutely despicable that our justice system focuses on the rights of offenders, convicted murderers, over the rights of victims and victims' families. It is not fair that this Van Wyk judgment allows for criminals, convicted murderers, rapists, serious criminals, to be looked at for parole after just 12 years and 4 months after committing a serious crime. My father's murderers were sentenced to 75 years in prison at minimum. That's 3 life sentences. They have not even served one. How is that justice?
I think the system is cruel. I think the system, you almost get the feeling that it is offender-centric as opposed to victim-centric. And, you know, we're the good guys. Those guys that are in jail, they put themselves in. And I speak for many South Africans. We're just one of many that are going through these emotions. You know, people walk down the street and they find all of a sudden the rapist is in town and they didn't even know about it. How can that be?
These murderers don't have to apply for parole. They automatically get considered for parole. And that's the one thing that just irks me so much, is the fact that they don't even have to do any work and then they can get out of prison. So the Van Wyk judgment, which allows these mass murderers, rapists, serial killers, the possibility of getting out on parole earlier than anticipated. And I think that for us, it's our duty as South Africans to educate the majority on what this means, because ultimately, who's going to have to pay the price are South Africans who have to invite them back into the community.
I will not be signing some secrecy or confidentiality agreement in that parole hearing. What happens there, I will be publicizing, because I am not just going to look the other way and have to fear that these men are going to be out on the streets, the same streets that my child has to be on, to and worry that we could come into contact with them, or that anyone could come into contact with them.
The interviews for this piece were conducted by Gillian Gifford. This is a developing story. To have a look at Roxanne van Eck's online petition, please go to change.org/cop-killer. And to have a look at Lee Visser's petition, check out change.org/sizzlers-massacre. For Multimedia Live, I've been Paige Muller.